This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago on the South Lawn of the White House. President Biden and his wife hosted a July 4th barbecue with active duty military families. The commander-in-chief praised them for their service to the nation.
You are the sinew, the backbone, the reality of why we're who we are. Unbreaking, unbending.
Severe weather is not making things easier for Americans looking to travel this holiday. CBS's Chris Van Cleve reports from Phoenix.
Beachgoers in Rhode Island ran for cover after storms rolled in. And in nearby Johnston, two children were injured after being struck by a falling tree brought down by wind, according to the fire department. Elsewhere, severe weather brought flights to a halt at major hub airports in Denver and New York.
A lot of people are expected to hit the road this summer.
I'm Jim Crisill along Interstate 75 in Jellico, Tennessee. Pent-up travel demand from the COVID-19 pandemic is expected to lead to record summer travel nationwide. Stacy Hemmings and her family have the travel bug itch.
Last year, we were planning to go to Arcadia in Maine, and when we thought about how much it would have cost, we said, let's wait, so we're actually leaving next week.
While gas prices are down significantly from this time last year, airfares and hotel rates are up. Some hotels are charging twice what they did a year ago for rooms.
Five people are dead and two wounded, and Philadelphia police don't yet know what sparked last night's shooting. They say the suspect, who's now in custody, was armed with a rifle, pistol, extra magazines, and wearing a bulletproof vest. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney.
This country needs to reexamine its conscience and find out how to get guns out of dangerous people's hands.
In Fort Worth, Texas, no arrests in last night's fatal shootings of three people and wounding of eight others after a festival. CBS's Linda Kenyon has the latest on a substance recently found in the White House.
A preliminary test shows the white powder found inside the White House Sunday night was cocaine. The substance, which is undergoing further testing, prompted an elevated security alert and a brief evacuation. It is not yet known how it got inside the building. President Biden was not at the White House at the time.
The Secret Service will lead a full review of how the substance got into the White House. Police in Hilton Head, South Carolina, are investigating a deadly alligator attack. CBS's Jerika Duncan reports.
A 69-year-old woman was killed this morning while walking her dog near a golf course lagoon. First responders removed the gator from the area. Last summer, an 88-year-old woman was killed by an alligator in the same county.
Russia says it foiled a Ukrainian drone attack on Moscow as Kyiv's counteroffensive grinds on. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
I'm Cameron Hall.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Senator Tammy Baldwin is criticizing two Supreme Court decisions last week. She's talking about the court's ruling on affirmative action in college admissions and a case that allows discrimination against people based on sexual orientation. Baldwin says both rulings are matters of fairness and freedom. She says she's worried about the broader implications of the court's decisions in the future. Eight people are doing better today after getting stuck hanging upside down on a roller coaster for about 3 hours in Crandon Sunday. Nobody was hurt, but one person did go to the hospital. It happened on the last day of the Forest County Festival. Channel 7 in Wausau reports seven of the stuck passengers were kids. Inspectors were still looking into the cause of the mechanical breakdown last we checked. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
U.S. Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap. This is 93.5 The Tap.
Can get. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. So back here in Erie, Pennsylvania, UE Local 506's Union Hall covering the UE strike. Now, you know, we talk about strikes from the workers' perspective. We talk about contracts. We talk about all of that stuff. But I don't think we're spending enough time on the political side of this. Right now in Washington, D.C., we've got, you know, at least the most pro-union president in my lifetime, if not, you know, one of the top two ever. And that's a good thing. But, you know, we still got workers out on the picket lines. We still got people who feel that they have to go out and strike because they're just not being heard. But the political side of this is really, really important. That's why I've asked Jim Wirtz to come sit down with us. Jim is the Erie County Democratic Party chair here locally. And, in fact, if you remember back when we were here back in October for the Working Class Heroes radio tour, Jim was the guy who put the entire Erie stop together. In fact, we made Jim a verb. If he needed something done, we were going to Wirtz it. That's why I've asked Jim to come sit down with us. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me back. Pleasure.
It's great seeing you again. And look, you know, thanks for everything you did back in October. This was one of the best stops on the tour.
Great, great. Glad it all worked out.
So, again, here we're in this situation. You got workers out on the street. As we're talking to people, they didn't have an option. It's the last arrow in the quiver. What's the political side of this? You know, you hear it from the worker side. What's the political side of this?
Look, I think, you know, you mentioned that we have the most labor-friendly, union-friendly president in your lifetime and certainly in my lifetime. I think when we look at the political spectrum right now, one party, not mine, is the one is consistently anti-union in all their approach. Certainly there are some members of the Republican caucus, but have some pro labor leanings, but they're increasingly in a shrinking minority, and so as we look across the political landscape, we're looking for people who are willing to even say the word union sometimes, and that's an unfortunate reality that we face. So candidates and elected officials who are willing to stand up and put themselves out there on behalf of working men and women are really to be treasured in this moment, especially as we're kind of, I think, as a society, rethinking what the labor movement means, rethinking what unionism means.
No, and we're seeing a lot more labor activity, a lot more strikes going on, a lot more organizing going on. And I've said for a very long time, the reality is, and you're very generous in your critique of the other side. I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do, because I don't see any of them coming to the defense at this moment. Did they put on the comfortable shoes and start walking the picket line?
Well, I think there have been maybe one or two out here in campaign season this year. But in general, no. In general, you're not going to see those folks standing up for working people. At the same time, we have an incredibly pro-union Democratic caucus here in Pennsylvania. We've got an incredibly anti-union Republican caucus, and that fight is going to go to the bitter end. I think all of our local Republican elected officials here have come out in favor of right to work and voted consistently for right to work. And that's an abomination here in 2023 as we're thinking about what it takes to raise a family, what it takes for people to put the next meal on the table. And so they're not seeing their constituents. They're not hearing their constituents. They don't understand really what the needs are of Pennsylvanians generally, because this is an incredibly important time and really an opportunity for us to move working people forward and get a little further up the ladder.
And not just the workers. I mean, the entire community. I mean, as I'm talking to people here, this company is a part of the heart of this, the soul of this community. You know, as this company and these workers go, the community goes. So politically, you know, there's this part of me that goes, look, I've said it before, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And as you've just said, you know, they push, you know, the whole no rights at work agenda. You would think, though, that they would want to get out there and say, hey, let's get back to the table. Let's be encouraging. Hey, let's treat these workers like the heroes in the essential workforce that they are. But it's crickets. And this is where the shoe leather meets the road, man.
You know, Republicans love to talk about economic development and all of these things. And in economic development, everybody likes to talk about the multiplier effect. But there is no greater multiplier effect in communities like ours than working people who are making a sustainable family supporting wage. And we see it from unions like UE506 all the time. When these guys are out on the line and they're not collecting a paycheck, there's literally tens of thousands and ultimately millions of dollars over time that aren't going back into the community, into nonprofits, into little league groups, into the toy drives that they have, into the other things that they do to support community organizations. And without the unions that are here, regardless of what their affiliation is, regardless of what industry or trade they belong to, you see these guys show up time and time again for community initiatives. If they don't have their own security, if they're not taken care of for the work that they're doing, they're not going to be able to reciprocate that back out into the community and help take care of the folks that aren't there.
You know, this is one of those moments, though. This is, you know, the old labor frame. Which side are you on? You know, for me, this is one of those moments, and this is one of those moments that, you know, Democrats need to step to the forefront as well. You know, for the last at least year, I've been saying Democrats need to adopt a striker. There should be every politician who takes on a striking worker and walks with them, helps walk in their shoes, and really pushes the agenda forward, because this is how we're going to rebuild the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization. Not with flowery words, not with you know, pats on the back, but with actions.
That's right. There's a lot of rhetoric surrounding unionism and surrounding organizing right now. But the reality is that we do need more folks in the political sphere to step up and to be on the right side of labor. There's a conversation that happens in this community every time there's a major contract negotiation about, do these people make too much money? The cost of living is lower in Erie, PA, so why do they need to make $35 an hour? Well, that's not how we should measure anything. as you try to keep your head off the table with that statement, right? This is the fight that we have. Well, why as we're fighting to bring minimum wage workers up to a living wage, would we try to force highly skilled laborers back down to the minimum living wage possible? This is an opportunity where we need to really evaluate, one, the quality and the value of the products that are being produced, the skill of the work that these guys and women bring to the table, and ultimately, at the end of the day, make sure that they're compensated, that the profits of this company and others make their way through the entire corporate food chain.
And the workers get what they earn. You know, I love people say, well, we deserve. No, you don't deserve it. You earn it. There's a huge difference there. Nobody gives you anything. You worked for it. You made that company profitable. Without you, there's nothing there.
And they work hard. They show up for overtime, whether they want to or not. They're there day in and day out, and they make sure that the products that are being pushed off the line are of the highest quality, so that those consumers, whether they're corporates or individuals, that those consumers are coming back time and time again. And that's the only way this relationship's going to work. Here in Erie, I mean, you have UE looking at the future of locomotive manufacturing and thinking about how to green this out and thinking about how to make it more efficient, more economic, and for the company to resist entering into that conversation because it's being started by the union, I think is a sign of the times and incredibly detrimental and disappointing.
I mean, the reality is, had the auto industry listened to the UAW back in the 60s, they probably wouldn't have the problems they have,
right,
you know, through the 90s, 2000s, and now. And this is where the people closest to the problem, maybe they're part of the solution. Thoughts?
Well, the folks, as you talk about the folks where the rubber meets the road, man, the people doing the job every day know where the line needs to go, so to speak. They know what's going to make their job more efficient, not somebody sitting in a cubicle or an office a couple hundred miles away. And so as we look at the current situation, the fact that these guys have to enter into a strike as part of the negotiation to get to a point where they have a real grievance structure, where they can articulate problems in the shop and on the floor and try to rectify them in a reasonable way, and the fact that they can't get to that part of the conversation with the company, I think is an incredibly telling sign of where we are as a corporate community.
Well, you know, as a society, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, they want to be dictators.
Yeah.
You know, they want that. You know, I bring it up all the time. Pennsylvania's workers' compensation law still refers to the employer-employee relationship as master and servant. That's what corporate America wants. They want good little servants to do the work and then not share in the spoils. And a moment ago, you said, you know, $35 an hour. Some people say that's too much. I always ask the other side of this. Well, how much do you make? And that's probably not enough.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily. It's not necessarily producing the same thing, right? I mean, it's contributing to the product, but it's not producing the product. We need to look at this comprehensively. And you're right. There are people throughout the food chain. Before these guys went on strike, I had put out a press release issuing our support for UE 506 and 618 and talking about the fact that when these guys have a good contract, when their work is strong, everybody around them is equally strong. And the more that their wages are depressed, the more that their working conditions are put into question, the more everybody's working conditions are going to be put into question, and the more everybody's wages are going to be suppressed. It is a line that these guys know that we need to hold, and I think the community understands that as well.
No, that is such an excellent point. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Jim Wirtz. He's the Erie County Democratic Party chair here in Erie, Pennsylvania. ErieDems.com, I think?
That's correct.
I hope folks will check out the website. Now, you know, what you just said there a moment ago is, I think, really important. When this place does well, when these workers do well, the community does well. You know, the dollar raise that they don't get is the dollar that isn't spent at Dombrowski's around the corner or the local hardware store. It's money that isn't reverberating through the local economy. And as you said, it hurts everyone all the way down the food chain, which is why, you know, in talking to people here, the community seems to be, you know, pretty solidly behind them.
They are, just as they were 4 years ago. I mean, the community understands the value of this institution in particular and the value of the workforce that's here supporting this institution. And I think as we get a little bit further down the road, that understanding will only grow, will only expand. You know, I think with the decline of unionism over the past 40 years, it kind of fell off of the front of people's minds. And so every once in a while, when we have a moment like this, where there is a tough negotiation, where there are folks out on strike, it's great to see the community rally behind them and to come back around to those traditional ideals that working folks drive this community forward. We saw it, ABSCUF saw it in 2016 when we were out on strike for a few days. These guys certainly saw it in 2019, and the community is coming back to rally for them again here in 2023.
It's good stuff. Now, I want to change a little bit over to the political side of this, because Erie, this area, you know, kind of the decider, if you will.
Sure.
How Erie goes, the state usually goes, and how Pennsylvania goes, national elections may go. Do you see this playing into some of that, perhaps? At some point, does the president, you know, make a mention of this? Do you see something along those lines?
Well, you know, we saw the lieutenant governor here last week showed up on the strike line, and I think and you're seeing other folks kind of issue statements of support. John Fetterman and Bob Casey just issued statements of support this past week. So I do think that as we go forward, you're going to continue to see that. I think where the folks that are interested in what's right will be out here, will show their support for these folks. And the guys that are trying to make a political calculation about how many of these rank and file guys are going to vote for them as opposed to somebody else, you know, they're making the wrong decision on this. And so I think by and large, politicians understand, and the ones who are willing to do right by their community are going to be out here and are going to make, at the very least, make statements and support.
No. One of my biggest knocks of President Obama was, you know, he made the comment, I'm going to get comfortable shoes and you know, walk the picket line. Never found those comfortable shoes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look at Jelly Bucket Joe, man. He's out there doing the work. Rebuilding, you know, Builder Biden is doing the work.
That's right.
And I just wish we would do a little bit more, you know, pointing that out.
A little more celebration of it. I know, you know, sometimes it's hard to cut through the noise. There's a lot of noise around the administration, around just what's happening generally in the Republican caucuses and in the Republican Party.
Oh, you mean the clown show over there?
The anti-democratic clown show. I mean, it's anti-democratic small d. Forget that they hate us. They seem to hate everyone. And so here we are heading headstrong into a presidential election year. And it's very difficult to get folks, not only in mainstream media, but even around the dinner table, to talk about the successes that we're seeing under this administration. I mean, the blows that were handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday, I think this administration will be creative enough to see how they can help to reconcile that and make sure that everybody is afloat, not only for the next election year, but heading forward into the future. This is the first administration I can think of in a long time that is making big plays, long-term plays that are going to have reverberating effects for my kids' generation and maybe even for their kids.
No, it's transformational. I mean, some of the, you know, I talk about this all the time, the fact that we're moving away from the supply side voodoo Reaganomic neoliberal model towards reshoring manufacturing and investing in infrastructure and doing the things that we need to be doing at home. That is huge. And that's why I brought the administration up here, because you mentioned a second ago potential of bringing on green technologies, you know, electric locomotives, the future of transportation, and to have it done here. This seems to be kind of a perfect storm scenario where you've got the administration pushing this stuff, you got the workers here pushing for that stuff. The only problem is you got a company that not so much.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's in their thought process, what's in their business model and their forecasting that prohibits them from getting on board, pun fully intended, on this idea, right? I mean, across the world, people are clamoring for alternative fuel locomotives, alternative fuel cars. I mean, we're in a position here in Erie, PA, to really lead that transformation, and not just for this industry, by the way. I mean, I think there's a number of industries where Erie is well situated to be the center point if people can just start to look at that big picture and really just enter into the conversations with folks that want to help do the work and want to help move it forward.
Well, as I said, Erie's like the pulse. However this area goes, this state kind of goes. So you keep up the good work and moving, ushering people in the right direction.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
I appreciate the time, Jim. Thanks so much. Jim Wirtz, he is the chairman of the Erie County Democratic Party. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Back here from Erie, Pennsylvania. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at thericksmithshow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. So as we spend some time here in Erie on the UE WabTech picket line, run into a bunch of people who are doing great work. You know, people who aren't UE members, folks who are saying, you know, this is important. I want to be part of it. And, you know, look, UE has done an incredible job since January of organizing graduate student workers across the country. Some 14,000 members they have added as graduate workers. And one of them decided, hey, I'm going to come down here and I'm going to be participating in this. That's why I've asked Jacob Ranking to come sit with us. He's a grad worker at Northwestern University, part of their union. Jacob, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely.
So let me, the first question out of the bag, why'd you come? Why are you here?
Honestly, to experience a picket and to learn more about the UE family, where we joined UE last year. We voted to unionize in January. I haven't personally had a lot of contact with other locals. This was a great chance to kind of learn what the struggle's about at one of the oldest locals there is.
Is this your first picket line?
Yes, it is.
What's it been like?
It's been fantastic. Everyone's been very kind. There's been huge organization everywhere, and it's a fantastic feeling to see how everyone is completely united around the issues that they're fighting for, but also about, around the issues that we're facing as a nation and as working class everywhere.
It really is a unique feeling, isn't it? I mean, I've been on hundreds of picket lines, and every time you're there, it's that, just what you said, it's that sense of community, that sense of solidarity that you can feel in the air.
Yeah, you just don't have any kind of feeling of people are having disagreements or anything. Everyone is completely united. Everyone's taking care of everyone else. There's this huge solidarity that I got when we were organizing the union and going through the election and everything, but it's just so much more present here.
No, it's like I've said, you know, thousands of times on this show, we got to take off the red hats and the blue hat, put on a hard hat, and we can rebuild anything. And when we unionize people, we bring people together in the workplace, we can reunite this country in ways that we haven't done in a very long time. So, you know, look, you as a graduate worker moving in a direction to say, look, you know, my work matters. We should be compensated fairly. Tell me about the experience of going through that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm in a second year program. I'm in the hard sciences. So I'm in lab every day. And the amount of just dangerous materials and dangerous conditions that we're exposed to in the hard sciences is unbelievable. At the same time, I talk to friends in the humanities and the amount of just exploitation that they're getting is unbelievable. And so it makes a lot of sense for us to unionize. It makes a lot of sense for us to be doing this organizing ourselves and for us to decide what our structure is going to be, where UE is just a fantastic fit for us. But honestly, especially through the pandemic, when we in the hard sciences, we got maybe 3 weeks before we were forced back into lab as essential workers. My office, there's seven of us in there. Northwestern said it's safe for one person to be in there at any given time. So there's just this kind of disregard for our own safety, for our own work-life right. balance that we have to unionize to actually get our opinions through.
Now, what do you say to the people who go, you know, but Jacob, you know, in the past, people had to put up with this stuff. You're just paying your dues.
Yeah, I mean, that's an argument to make, but I think it's not a very good one because in the past things were bad doesn't mean I also have to go through all these terrible conditions and be treated like crap, honestly.
No, I'm right there with you. So, you know, for me, the exciting part of seeing graduate workers unionize is these are young people. These are people who are taking the initiative to say, look, we're not putting up with this garbage anymore. We want better. We earn better. We do better. And you guys are going to move on to other careers down the line and take this experience with you. So for me, that's the exciting part because we're rediscovering solidarity.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's so much we learned. There's also just fantastic at every university that's been on strike. Our experience around unionizing has been, we talk to the undergrads. The undergrads are more than just happy to learn about unionization. They're really excited for us. The solidarity we get from undergraduate students who have no skin in the game, really, is fantastic. And they're also going to move on and go into industry, go into jobs, and have that experience, have learned about unionization, not from who they should have learned it from, but from fellow students.
No, that is fabulous stuff. So what's the message for the folks on strike here? What message do you bring from Northwestern? What message from your background is, as you've seen that you've been on the picket line, you got any words for them?
Oh, we're right there with you, and we're going to be here every time you need us. Anything you need, reach out to us. We'll be there because you all have helped us in our fight to unionize. You're there with us. You're helping us along the way. You're giving us all this infrastructure, all this support. We have to return that because that's what solidarity is.
Jacob, outstanding stuff. It was really great seeing you. Great meeting you. I wish you the best. Thanks for taking some time for us.
Thank you so much.
Good stuff, Jacob Ranke, graduate worker at Northwestern University. We'll take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1930. That was the day some 1,300 labor radicals and Communist Party supporters assembled in Chicago to establish the National Unemployed Council. That spring, councils in major cities across the country held massive rallies for jobs and relief. They were responding to near-catastrophic conditions created by the stock market crash. Delegates emerged from the founding convention with an organizational structure and demands for action. These included unemployment insurance, cash and work relief, public works at union wages, free food for children of unemployed, and a moratorium on evictions. Delegates acknowledged that African Americans bore the worst of the unfolding depression. They worked to address racial discrimination as part of an integrated push for jobs and relief. Councils were established throughout 46 states. They were best known for massive demonstrations, hunger marches, and rent strikes. Councils mobilized hundreds, sometimes thousands, quickly to march on city halls or relief offices when benefits were threatened. They were also able to mobilize scores of supporters at a moment's notice to stop evictions. Councils often mobilized the unemployed to bolster picket lines during strikes. This undercut the recruitment of scabs. By 1935, the National Unemployed Council merged with other socialist unemployed groups led by the Socialist Party and A.J. Mustey to form the Workers' Alliance. According to sociologist Chad Allen Goldberg, the Workers' Alliance worked to secure, quote, more WPA jobs, higher wages for WPA workers, and application of new federal labor laws to the WPA. Goldberg attributes their demise by 1941 to a combination of factors, including the rise of a powerful anti-labor coalition of Republicans and Southern Democrats, red baiting, and internal political conflicts.
Two pieces of good advice. Never sign nothing by neon, and never negotiate with snakes. But Joe Biden violated both rules this year, getting out-negotiated by Senate Republicans and their tag-along Democrat Joe Manchin. As a result, Biden completely surrendered an urgently needed program for America, universal child care. The U.S. child care system is broken at every level. Availability is scarce, and even if parents can find an opening, the price is forbidding. Yet, care providers and teachers are grossly underpaid. So we're doomed by corporate greed and Washington's indifference, right? Wrong. Grassroots people across the country are demanding and getting real change at the state level. Last year, for example, voters in New Mexico rallied a decade-long care rebellion to put a landmark initiative on the ballot to guarantee that all children ages 0 to 5 have a constitutional right to quality early childhood education. Moreover, Amendment 1 allocates a steady stream of money from New Mexico's land-grant permanent fund to make this promise real. The vote initiative passed with 70% of the vote. Vermont, led by such persistent grassroots groups as Let's Grow Kids, is providing $130 million a year to establish a solid base for universal child care. Last month, the Republican governor vetoed the funding provision, but a bipartisan legislative majority, prodded by public demand, has now voted to override the veto. Also, the red state legislature in Tennessee is providing a new and essential child care benefit to low-income parents of infants and toddlers, diapers. And even some in the U.S. Congress are beginning to get the child care message, having formed the first-ever Congressional Dads Caucus to push family-friendly policies. This is Jim Hightower saying, when leaders won't lead, the people must shove them out of the way.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So here in Erie, Pennsylvania, talking about this strike, again, you know, as we've been talking to people, the general consensus is nobody knows why it's going on. Asking for things that are out of bounds, it just seems like, well, the company may have overshot their hand. But here to share some thoughts on the history here and also where we are right now, I've asked Al Hart to come talk with us. Al is a retired GE worker, also UE staffer. I understand Web Tech was GE before. This is the plant, the history here, long, long history of militant labor here. So Al is a wealth of information. Al, I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Thanks for putting me on.
So let's start with, what do you think about what's going on right now?
Well, I'm very happy with it. I don't live in Erie anymore. I live in Pittsburgh. I was just summing up what you said, I started out as a worker here 50 years ago, worked in this plant for 13 years, active in this local, was on the executive board of this local. Then I went on the UE staff. I was a field rep for 20 years, and then I was editor of the UE News for 11 years, and I retired in 2017. So I got a long history with this union. I have a long history with this local. And when I was coming up as a 20-something in the 1970s in this local, there were people around still in the leadership who had helped this local survive the McCarthy era.
Right.
This union, UE, and this local in particular, were big targets of the Red Scare in the 1950s. We had a rival union, the IUE, that was created to destroy UE. And they succeeded in many places. They never succeeded here. This is actually the biggest local of UE that didn't succumb to the Red Scare and the raiding by other unions. And it's an interesting story. A friend of mine actually wrote a book a few years ago about the history. It's very insightful. But anyway, this local has fantastic traditions. They've,
right.
You know, they've been militant. I was very proud to be part of this local when I was here, and I'm still very proud to be part of it. And I'm very proud to see, you know, in 2023, when supposedly young workers don't get it anymore, they don't understand what unions are for, they don't appreciate it, these folks here are completely upholding the traditions of this local. And as someone in my 70s who's been in this union for a long time, but also as someone who as a young person knew the generation before us, the generation that started this local and that kept this local under fire, it means a lot to me to see what these folks are doing right now.
Yeah, the transition, the changing of the guard, and still as militant. You know, one of the things I said, you know, we were here back in October, and this local, probably one of the most militant locals in the entire country, not just UE, but all the unions. And I got that sense and that feel here multiple times. And so this is not surprising to me to see where they are.
Well, one of the things they're fighting for, which we had, all GE workers in UE and in several other unions had for the 80-some years, was under the contract, if after the third step of the grievance procedure, we had the option of going on strike over a grievance. And we did it. We didn't do it all the time, but we did it enough times to get the message across. And my experience when I worked here, when we would have a grievance strike, maybe a one-day grievance strike, sometimes less than a whole full day, sometimes, you know, a four-day weekend. But for the next year, at least, sometimes longer, the company would be much more reasonable about grievances.
No, and this is the thing, and this is the
a powerful weapon to have.
Absolutely, and you know, you hit on something that made me think of the old timer that put me under his wing and said, "Hey, we're going to make a Teamster out of you." Yet, he said, you know, back in the 50s, you know, they used to go on strike every 5 to 6 years just because you're building that kind of militancy, that kind of solidarity that says, hey, we fought and won something. And you're not going to trade something that you fought for away for something right. for something meager. You're going to keep fighting, and once you get that, it's contagious. So I think we're kind of seeing that moment. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know that – I'm not in that plant anymore. I haven't been in that plant since 1986. But I know enough about that plant and what I'm hearing from the people today, you know, and it's not the same plant. We had 15,000 members in this local in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
We now have 1,400. So it's not as big, but it's still here. Given what's happened to the industrial working class in the United States, it's amazing that it's still here. Given what's happened to the industrial working class in Erie, because I drive around Erie. Every time I drive around Erie, as someone who hasn't lived here since the 80s, I get depressed. Because when I left here, and what's still in my mind as the image of Erie is factory after factory after factory, almost all of them unionized.
Yep.
People in this plant used to joke, people of my generation, we were the 20-somethings, we were the young rebels, if the company fires me or if I quit, I'll have a new job by the afternoon.
Yep.
And by new job, we meant a new union job.
Right.
That's not the case today. There's hardly anything left in Erie. Erie's a very depressed community, and this is the place where there's good-paying jobs with a union, but actually, but besides that, with a very militant union.
No, not just
a union in name only.
No, look, I grew up in Cleveland, and it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, there was manufacturing everywhere. You know, last October, we did the Working Class Heroes radio tour that brought us through here, and we went to a lot of places that used to be.
Yeah.
You know, Akron used to be the rubber capital. Toledo used to be the glass capital. You go across,
exactly.
You know, Wisconsin, you know, Appleton, Wisconsin paper. You could go to all these places. This was the heart and soul of those communities that have been eviscerated. And fortunately, you've been able to hold on to this and not lose your soul in the whole process.
Well, what impresses me about what's happening right now with this strike is when I was a young person, a young worker in this plant in the 1970s, it was easy to be militant because we had all kinds of fallbacks.
Right.
What I was just saying about other jobs being available. These workers don't have that, and they're fighting anyway. So in a way, they're outdoing my generation by quite a bit because we didn't have to fight under these conditions. Like, you got the only good job in town. Are you going to risk it? Well, yeah, we're going to risk it to keep it from becoming a shitty job. And that's necessary. And these folks are doing it, and I couldn't be more proud of my local.
So, you know, I look at this, and because what caught my attention, you were saying earlier that, you know, you're so proud of these younger people, and, you know, that, you know, again, you don't often hear this. You don't hear it from an old timer. Most of the time you get that curmudgeon, you know, in my day, you know, we were so much better than this.
You punks don't get it, you know. And they do get it.
And
that's what I'm saying.
That's important.
Yeah.
So, you know, in looking at what's going on here, you know, with where they are, where do you see this going? I mean, with your wealth of experience, the years that you've lived here, you've worked here, you've done
yeah.
all this stuff, what do you see?
Well, I think I know where the union's at. I'm pretty sure I know where the union's at. What I don't know is where this company's head is at. They don't seem very smart. I mean, this local struck them 4 years ago. You've probably reported this to your
yeah.
listeners when they bought the place and they tried to gut the GE, what was it, the conditions of the GE contract, and this local fought back and largely succeeded. But they didn't learn a damn thing from that. So in the history of this local union, I mean, besides the grievance strikes, which we're very proud of what we did with the right to strike for grievances, and we want to get it back, but to strike for a contract, in the history of this local, it only happened twice with General Electric. 1946, which was a national strike of all GE workers, and 1969, which was a national strike of a coalition of unions, because UE no longer represented everybody in GE. The union situation in GE was fractured.
Right.
But by 1969, in spite of all the bad blood of the 1950s, we got all the unions together. The unions that tried to destroy us were on the same side. And this is before I worked here, but I'm saying we collectively as a UE guy beat the company. And the whole time I worked for GE, we never had to go on strike for a contract because we were riding on the coattails of what people did in 1969. So General Electric had two contract strikes in 80 years. Wabtec comes in here, and in 4 years, they're on their second strike already. Something is wrong with these people. They're not very smart, I think. So I don't know what's going to happen because I don't know what's in their heads.
No, that's the thing. I mean, I was looking at the profit numbers. They're extraordinarily profitable. In fact, they're doing the stock buyback things. So, again, if you're going to buy back stocks and say, hey, we've got no productive use for this money, how about sharing it with the people who earn it?
Exactly. Which is, and, you know, I've never dealt with this company. I mean, not here. I've never dealt with this company at all as far as Wabtec. I have some knowledge of Wabco, which was their predecessor company, but not here, you know, in Pittsburgh. But they seem to be very arrogant and not, you know, not, and they, what
well,
I hear.
Mean, look, you got decades of corporate America getting their way. Of course they're going to be arrogant.
And, but what they really seem to go out of their way to disrespect the workers here. I mean, they sent this letter out telling people, fill out this form to resign from the union. No one sent them in. Nobody resigned from the union. They actually seem to believe their own bullshit. They tell people, if they make some threats, and then they tell people, we would like you to quit the union and come and be a scab, that people are going to do it. And it didn't work. And they were, I got the impression from what people told me that the company was shocked that the members rejected their final offer. I wasn't shocked at all. I would have been shocked I would have been shocked if it even had been close, which it wasn't.
Right.
So they really don't seem to have the pulse of their employees.
So what message for the workers here? What's as an old timer?
Keep up the good work. You're doing it right. I'm proud of you. People of my age group are proud of you. People that of the generation I learned from, if they were here and they're not, they would be very proud of you. So keep it up.
Good stuff, Al. I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with us.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks a lot, Rich.
Good stuff. Thank you, Al. Al Hart, UE retiree, UE staff retiree. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of that? You know, you proud of the younger generation? You don't hear that from older guys so much. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Thanks so much, Al. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at therickssmithshow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. One of the things I love about being on picket lines is you run across people who, you know, you may not otherwise meet. Today, you know, one of those days, all across the country, people have come to this picket line to show solidarity with these UE workers, with these Wabtec workers, and saying, hey, look, you know, we're going to stand behind you. And one of those folks is Vele Agarwal. He is a grad worker from the University of Chicago. They have organized, and he's come all the way from Chicago here to Erie to show a little solidarity. Vele, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So what brought you here? What made you go, hey, I want to get up and I want to go from Chicago to Erie?
So at University of Chicago, we are also a UE local, and we are gearing up for a contract fight. We just started our negotiations. And I came here to learn about, you know, the history of UE local, one of the oldest local here, and learning how they fight for a contract, how they implement a rank and file control with unit as large as 1,400 people. We are 3,000, but it's, you know, it's as big as I could find. And, learning the ideas of, you know, how does democracy work in this sort of situation? How do you actually get power from there? It's also just a great learning experience because I haven't been in a strike before, and I got to learn firsthand on how strikes are run, how strikes actually look on the picket lines, how it looks like in, you know, leadership rooms. And
you're actually in with the leaders, you know, as they're making the decisions and as they're planning this all out, to maybe take back with you.
Yeah. I mean, their ideas and their guiding principles. I mean, yes, we have, you know, UE staff that supports us, but also when you talk to other workers who have been doing this for so long, there are differences differences of what an advice is and what works on the ground and how you actually execute it, and just the fact that you are the one who's living with it.
Yeah, the leadership part of it, sure. Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah. Is this your first picket line?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Any thoughts?
Pickets are fun. I mean, I came in thinking that maybe there'll be stand up with the police or something, but just, you know, walking around, being in solidarity, having fun at picket is just a great way to, harm the
to be part of something. No, look, at the end of it, you know, as I've said, you know, this is rediscovering solidarity or discovering solidarity for the first time, understanding that, you know, there's something bigger than just the individual that we're not here in this country. We're not supposed to believe in.
Yeah.
So you're from India, right?
Yes.
In your home country, were you active in labor there? What made you become active in the labor movement here?
So not so much in India. So I did my high school, wasn't very involved in labor movement because I was focusing on my high school and undergrad education. And then right after finishing my undergrad education, I came to US, you know, didn't take a year off or month off, came to US directly. So my stay in India has been purely, you know, just reading and working towards my degree. So I didn't have, you know, a chance to work as a, you know, I wasn't working anywhere and so on. And when I came to US for PhD, I came here for just for getting a degree. But I think just the working conditions at University of Chicago, I see for myself and so many of my coworkers that, low pay, people are on food stamps while being a grad worker, people having to delay their families, not being able to take care of their teeth, high copay in medical insurances, and so on. And, you know, rampant PI abuse, you know, abuse from their supervisors.
Yeah.
And all of this is, you know, it sort of spoils the experience that that is romanticized towards getting a PhD in, you know, and in academia, the world of PhD is romanticized as this, oh, great learning experience and where you get to discover and, you know, settle your curiosities. And it's just not there, you know,
kind of hard to do, you know, this great stuff when you're hungry.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard when you can't keep a roof over your head. It's kind of hard when, you know, as you pointed out, your teeth are falling out.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Yeah. And all of this sort of, you know, there are issues there. And it's just, you know, one day a coworker came to my lab and said, hey, I didn't know them before, but they were like, oh, I also work in the building next to you. And, you know, what are your issues and what do you think, you know, what are some of the ways that can be resolved and how do you want to resolve it? And so, you know, they came to me, they talked to me about how there is a organizing effort at the campus and asked me to get involved and so on. And that sort of, you know, started me off with this organizing drive. You know, I took up the positions of communications chair in my union. Now we, you know, led the charge of communications throughout the last year, and we won our election last year, about 92%.
So you went from not really knowing much about labor, coming to this country, not knowing anything about U.S. labor, to now being one of the leaders in one of the a sizable local.
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Thanks.
No, I mean, it really is. I mean, it's an incredible story that I wish we could replicate a million times more. Mm-hmm. Because this is, again, this idea that we can change things, this empowerment that you clearly feel is contagious, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, at least I try to, and, you know, when I try to organize my fellow international workers, specifically from India and, you know, China, this is, you know, a lot of people are just, you know, I'm here to work on my PhD. University of Chicago is like 40% international. or at least our unit is, you know, 40% international workers who just come here for their PhD and probably will leave at least the university, if not the country or and Illinois. But
yeah, but I want them taking that back with them. I want them taking that sense of empowerment back with them and making change wherever.
Yeah, and so, I mean, this idea that you're here for 5 years is sometimes portrayed as don't get involved with unionizing, just work on your degree, face a little abuse, it's fine, it's going to blow over, and then it's life going to be fine. And but a lot of time, you know, you see people lose interest in academia because of the situation, working conditions, you know.
Yeah.
I see, you know, non-tenure track faculty who are, like, treated poorly, even though they are unionized. You know, other tenure track faculties, they're treated poorly. And so this whole state of academia where it's like, oh, if you want to be in academia, you have to suffer for 40 years until you become a burnout or you become a hotshot where you can abuse others and become the head admin of the university. And so
those are two ways you can go.
Yeah. And so there is this, you know, degradation of at least the education, higher education that is advertised in other countries that, oh, U.S. is great for education, higher education, you know, to get a postdoc graduate degree. But it's just, you know, a little underwhelming when I came here, and it's like, well, I have to stay here 5 years, so might as well change this.
You've taken to it, and it sounds like you're in the process of changing the world. Last question I've got for you. What do you say to the folks here that you walked the picket line with today? What's the message for them? What do you want them to know?
Oh, I mean, we are a relatively nascent, infant, basically an infant union, and there isn't a lot that our union can give for you, but
the fact that you're here is more than anything you can give. The fact that you're standing shoulder to shoulder with these guys and these women, that's it. Yeah.
And I mean, one thing that I will say is, like, graduate school, it's more young people and, you know, 20s, 30s, people in their 20s, 30s, as compared to maybe 50s in this plant. And we can say that the torch is being carried forward. We have 3,000 in U Chicago, 3,000 at Northwestern, about 20,000 all over the country who are ready to carry this, you know, rank and file worker rights movement forward from, you know, since whenever.
Yeah.
And we are really excited about it. And we'll be here. We'll support them in whatever way they can, but rest assured, the fight is going to continue.
Well, you're doing a great job. I love the work that you're doing, and I appreciate you sitting down with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Vale Agarwal. He is a grad worker at the University of Chicago and a UE member. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this, the crowd.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Hope you've enjoyed our day in Erie. And look, the stories of people who, I got to tell you, I think are heroes. These are the folks who are fighting for the future of a prosperous working class, fighting for what used to be that American dream of one income, being able to support a family, getting health care that is worth having, having something of a retirement down the road after decades of hard work and dedication and loyalty to these companies. This is the stuff we should be fighting for. Not just as the workers who benefit from it, but as the communities that these factories and these workers are in and these jobs are in. We should be fighting to make sure all jobs are family-sustaining wage jobs with all of the things that our grandparents' generation fought for. Look, you know, we used to be able to get by on one income. A family could get by, could survive, could do well, could thrive on one income. And then, hey, you know, well, you know, we're going to try this new gimmicky thing, crush unions, give tax breaks to rich people, outsource jobs. And then you needed two incomes. Magically, mom had to go to work because they needed to. It wasn't like my grandparents who, you know, my grandfather went off to work, my grandmother stayed home, raised the children, and then once they got to a certain age, went into the workforce for extra money, for retirement, for whatever, whatever that was. And then, you know, my parents' age generation, they needed both incomes. And now it's a standard, gotta have it. In fact, you know, they're saying now you might need three incomes, which again, why are we seeing states like Iowa pursuing child labor law changes, massive child labor law changes? Because even they know you need three incomes in this day and age to get by. Three incomes. This is what we've done to the American dream. This is what we've done to the economy. This is what we've done to communities.